The last case this afternoon is Sean Hornseth v. Department of the Navy, 2018-11-88. Mr. Morris.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Jeremy Morris, counsel for the appellant, Sean Hornseth. Mr. Hornseth's position has been consistent before the Merit System Protection Board and in front of this Court, and the claim is simply this, that it's well established that due process protections apply to adverse employment actions, such as the one here. The due process requires a meaningful opportunity to be heard, and that part of that means in these types of cases that the deciding official must have the authority to consider some alternative penalty.
Well, the board has said that. The MSPB has said that, but we've never said that, right?
There's no case in front of this Court, that's correct, that specifically says that there must be some alternative. That's correct. I think that's an issue of first impression for this Court.
Suppose that you were to have an agency or even a federal statute that just said anyone who has been convicted of a felony cannot continue in employment with the federal government, period. And so somebody is convicted of a felony and they go up and they say, please don't kick me out of my job. And the deciding official says, I don't have any choice. You're gone. That's what the statute says. Would that be a violation of due process?
I think we have to take a step back and say, you know, we know the due process is a flexible concept.
No, that's got to have a yes or no answer.
In your theory of the case,
given that case, would you say that person has been deprived of due process because the decision maker didn't have the authority under the statute to give him his job back or any other job?
I think it would depend, and I'll try to explain why I say that. Let's take an example, for instance, where you have someone who's been convicted of a felony, they've been sentenced to life in prison, right? So we know that they can never come back to work. And so you have a statute that says, you know, if you're physically unable because you've been sentenced to a crime, you can never come back. In that case, I think the flexible nature of due process, you wouldn't have to have an alternative penalty there, right? It's essentially metaphysically impossible that that person's going to be able to come back to work. In your case, the only reason I say it depends is it would depend if the government previously said conviction doesn't disqualify you, right? And so that there had been a long history of the standing right. Under
Congress enacts, as of today, a statute that says no government employee who's been convicted of a felony can be employed by the government, period. End of statute. And then 6 weeks later, your client is convicted of a felony. Can your client claim lack of due process?
I think so. And let me give you another example of that. What if this Congress enacted a statute that said every criminal defendant shall be considered guilty by a jury as long as they've been charged by a prosecuting authority?
I dare say that would have a Sixth Amendment problem, but go ahead.
Right. I mean, but that's the same kind of analysis. Just because Congress says something doesn't make
it
consistent with due process.
Well, Congress says all the time that if you commit such and such a crime, the mandatory minimum sentence is 5 years.
Correct.
And the judge has no discretion in imposing the sentence.
That doesn't make the judges...
Some discretion above the minimum range, correct.
But that doesn't mean the judge is not acting as an appropriate decision maker.
Right. Let me see if I can come at your question from the backside, which is that we know from Loudermill, right, that the parameters of due process are not set by the statutes. That we always have to look at the Constitution. So I think in your case, we have to look at the situation. Does that statute, how was it enacted? What was the law before? And you have to kind of give some consideration to that. And in this case, I think that what you have to look at is that in prior years, there were alternatives here. We have the Merit System Protection Board cases that say you have to have an alternative, and I'll come back to that, I guess. But we have a situation where administrative leave was available as an alternative penalty. Then Congress changes that and says, no, you can only impose administrative leave for a very short period of time. So is that something that we just say, oh, Congress said it, and so that's good? Or is that a situation where we have to say, well, that's Congress essentially usurping or trying to trump the constitutional parameters of due process.
So what you're suggesting is that Congress's limitation on administrative leave is unconstitutional?
No, that's not what I'm saying at all. I'm saying that what they've essentially done is painted themselves into a corner when, you know, they enacted that modification to the administrative leave length. They, you know, that applies to a broad number of circumstances. One of the unintended consequences of that is it took away the sole alternative remedy in these very narrow number of indefinite suspension cases where their person works for a facility where there's no alternative positions available and things like that. So what the Navy needed to do before they proceeded with an indefinite suspension action was to ensure that there was some constitutional guarantee of an alternative penalty available. If that sort of answers your question from the backside.
Well, I guess what you would then say with respect to my hypothetical is that if there were no alternative remedy, then the decision maker who told this guy, I don't have any choice, Congress has told me you've committed a felony, if you've committed a felony, you're out, that that would be a violation of due process. I think that's where the long answer ended up.
Yeah, I think you would agree with me, perhaps. We could come up with a number of hypotheticals, I suppose, but what if we just came up with a hypothetical that said Congress came up with a statute that said in the adverse employment actions, the deciding official shall not change the decision of the commander, that they can either find that it was met, but they can't change the penalty at all. Would that be sufficient just because Congress has put forth a statute that says that? I don't think so. I think you have to always take a step back and apply the Matthews factors. What's the private interest? What's the government interest? What's the risk of an erroneous deprivation? You always, in any circumstance, have to take a step back and apply that. And the reason I think it due process should apply here, notwithstanding the number of cases that say that it does, including one from this court, is that when you're dealing with an indefinite suspension based on a security clearance suspension, we're talking about things that are, to a certain degree, uncertain, right? The outcome of that parallel security clearance process, we don't know yet. It's been suspended. It hasn't been reached its final termination through the PSAB. So the outcome's uncertain here. It's different than when the person's committed a felony and the statute says you've committed a felony.
It can be on appeal. The felony conviction.
Well, then I guess that's the question. You know, we'd have to look at what does the statute mean. Does it have to mean you're convicted of a felony, period, and that's enough, whether regardless of whether it's vacated? I mean, there can be some exceptions to that, but in that case, it's a pretty clear-cut situation. When we have a suspension when you have a security clearance that's suspended, the outcome's a bit unclear here, right? It's just a different situation than if we had a security clearance that had already been revoked and a final determination had been made there. So we've got an outcome uncertain situation. We've got an indefinite suspension that's tied to that, right? The termination date for the indefinite suspension is when that process plays out. So there's a lot of unknowns here, as opposed to is it a yes or a no question? We don't know the outcome of that process. And so
what should the decision maker, assuming that the decision maker were to conclude that he or she had authority to come up with a different penalty, what would be the penalty that you would think the decision maker should have elected? Because I gather administrative leave was not available, even though the decision maker believed that it was.
Our whole argument is that there was not one available. That's the problem.
Even though there was perhaps a misapprehension on the part of the decision maker as to its availability, but okay. And we know that investigative leave presumably was not available. What should have happened to Mr. Harnsett?
Well, the Navy had several choices. Number one, it could have waited to start the adverse action until the security clearance procedures had terminated.
Well, but that would mean that he would have been in a security sensitive position during a time when he didn't have a clearance.
No, they could have put him on investigative leave in lieu of...
Investigative leave, let's assume, and I think it seems to be probably true, that investigative leave is not available here.
Right, but it's not available now because the adverse action has started. But what I'm saying is the Navy could have taken a step back. Instead of even pursuing an adverse action, they could have said, we're going to put you on investigative leave, wait and see what happens on the security clearance, and then start the adverse action. And if you look at the investigative leave statute and the now administrative leave statute, I mean, that's the process that the Congress has laid out in those new procedures, right? So when you receive detrimental information about the employee, you can put them on brief notice leave, put them on investigative leave, figure out if you want to take an adverse action or not, and then pursue that. So they could have done that in lieu of it. They could have.
That isn't an option that was open to the decision maker.
That's correct. And that's
right,
the problem.
So we're talking about here what options were available
right, there
to
the were
decision
no,
maker. So you're the decision maker in this case. What do you say to yourself, okay, what choice do I have? What should I do? My counsel has told me that I need to exercise a different option from simply saying suspension.
Right. And that, the problem is the decision maker had no choice here. That's exactly the problem. That's why it wasn't a meaningful hearing. It was a rubber stamp.
But that would have been true of anyone in the agency, would it not? Is there anyone in the agency that would have been in a different position from Mr. Combs?
No, not.
So there's no decision maker that could have, in your view, adjudicated this case.
Right. And my problem is not with the decision maker as a person. It's with the process. I mean, they have not come up with, they've eliminated every alternative penalty available to the decision maker, whoever that is. And that's the problem. And I would just note, this court has decided in Gargiulo that due process does apply to an adverse action that's based on a security clearance. They have not, this court didn't address a specific issue that Your Honor asked me about, whether or not this court had ever said that an alternative had to be available. You have said the due process applies to an adverse action based on security clearance in that case. And I'll reserve the rest of my time.
We will hold it for you, Mr. Yale.
May it please the court. I'd first like to address Judge Bryson's hypothetical. So there, if you look at Loudermill and even the Blaina case that from the board, there's no constitutional right for proceeding for leniency. I mean, the government doesn't have to provide a process for somebody to come in and argue that there needs to be leniency for that individual when the requirements are met. Constitutional due process just requires notice and an opportunity to be heard.
Yes, but an opportunity to be heard in a meaningful way, right? I mean, you can't simply say, we'll give you an opportunity to be heard. We've got a GS2 custodian over here who will hear your action, your arguments, and he doesn't speak English, but, you know, go ahead and argue away.
Well, Your Honor, that's certainly not what happened here. And I
understand, you were kind of saying, well, there isn't a requirement for an adjudicator who has authority in this situation. It seems to me
they have to have authority to take action, which actually happened in this case. I mean, Mr. Combs, as the deciding official, had authority. Now, was his review limited? It was limited, but it was limited because the substance of what he was reviewing was limited. And that's based upon this court's decisions and based upon Egan. There just needs to be a review of whether or not he needed a security clearance, whether or not it was suspended, and whether the 7513 procedures were complied with. Now, if the procedures weren't complied with, he had the authority to not approve the suspension. If this individual did not need a clearance, and there's plenty of government workers that don't actually need a security clearance, if that's the case, he does not need to go forward with the suspension. You know, if there was a case of mistaken identity, it was John A. Smith. This person was John B. Smith. But here, the notion that constitutional due process requires more, when what we have here is an adverse action that's one-to-one related to the suspension of the security clearance. This isn't a misconduct adverse action. There's no other charges here. And so the notion that the Constitution requires an alternative that Congress has not provided, I mean, that's not in any case other than the two cases that Mr. Morris has cited, Deal and McGriff. And those cases were modified by Buena. I mean, those cases are not even good law for that proposition, the balancing test set out. If you look at footnote 7 in Buena, they specifically address the fact that that's not even the board's law at this point. The board, in the Buena decision, has even said that to the extent there's alternatives that are prohibited by law, impractical, outside management's purview, the deciding official does not need to consider those alternatives. So that's what we have here.
Let me give you an example. I mean, it does seem to me there's something to this notion that the deciding official has to have some degree of authority with respect to penalty. Suppose you had the following situation. Suppose that the regulations of the agency said the head of a facility, but only the head of a facility, can exercise discretion in a case in which the individual has been found to be not entitled to security clearance, to give that individual a non-secure job, even if it means they basically have to kind of give them a make-work job. But in appropriate cases of need or, you know, a sympathetic case, the head of the facility can give that individual such a job. Would that mean, but no one else can. So if they assign someone who doesn't have that authority to be the deciding official in that case, would that mean there would be a problem in terms of the fairness of the proceeding?
Well, I think that issue has already been decided by the court. I think that's the Griffin decision, where to the extent that there is a substantive guarantee of an additional position that needs to be provided, then the agency needs to consider that.
There's no guarantee. It's completely discretionary on the part. What I'm trying to get you to address is whether, if you have someone in the chain of command who has discretion to choose a different penalty, is that a violation of the right of the individual not to have access to the person who has that discretion?
Well, I mean, we certainly don't think that this court or any court has ever held that. And I certainly think that no, because it just requires notice and an opportunity to be heard. And the issue here is
opportunity to be heard by someone who, even though someone in the agency could grant any number of different choices of alternative remedies, the person that they chose doesn't have that authority, but that's okay?
Well, that's obviously not the situation here, but
the deciding official has to be able to exercise the authority of the agency in this respect.
To the extent that there were regulations setting out that there could be a different position that was provided, I mean, to the extent that that's the case, then I suppose that the agency may have to, you know, I think it's not a matter of constitutional due process. It's a matter of sort of the statutory guarantee and the regulations. But to the extent it's viewed as that, that was not the situation here. And in fact, to the extent we're considering alternatives, if there need to be any alternative that were considered, here, there were alternatives. One was administrative leave. Now, the statute says there can be no more than 10 days of administrative leave, but that's an alternative. Is it a satisfactory alternative in terms of whether or not Mr. Hornseth would deem that acceptable because it's only 10 days? Well, it's an alternative, but I think even in Homar, I believe it was Justice Scalia said that, I mean, the government has a strong interest in not having individuals who cannot come to work, there's no requirement that they need to be paid to sit at home, essentially. And so administrative leave was one option. The other option that was considered but not followed through with because the agency official didn't believe it was appropriate was whether or not there was another position at this particular base that didn't require security clearance. The agency, through the deciding official, looked at that, and he made a finding that it would be fiscally irresponsible, and he didn't have the ability, he didn't have the authority to create a separate position. But the notion that, to the extent there are no alternatives, Mr. Hornseth prevails here, that's just simply not the case. There was an alternative between whether or not there was an indefinite suspension or whether or not he did not meet the substantive requirements. And it is a limited review, but that's just the nature of this review based upon the fact that the security clearance is all really that's being decided in this adverse action. It's a one-to-one relationship. And so, you know, we certainly don't think that there's been a violation of constitutional due process here. I mean, I'm happy to also address the ex parte communication argument now. I mean, as we laid out in our briefs, we don't think that there's been any evidence of any sort of derogatory information that influenced the decision maker here. And again, I think what that's a product of is the limited review. There's no dispute that his position required a clearance. It was suspended. And, you know, based upon that, there were very few communications that needed to happen in terms of the final decision. And we certainly don't think that the Stone Ward factors were met here. We can also address the judicial estoppel argument, although we would point out that this is it's this court's, you know, duty to review the law. That's a legal issue. And we also contest the fact that that was really our position as opposed to Mr. Hornseth's position in front of the board. If you take a look in the appendix at our briefs that the Navy had. If there's nothing further, we request that the court affirm the judgment of the board.
Thank you, Mr. Yale. Mr. Morris has a little time left.
Thank you. The government just pointed out the previous decision that noted that the government itself has a strong interest in not having people or paying people that aren't able to come to work. And that's part of the due process analysis, right, the government interest. But the flip side of that is that there's a private interest. Mr. Hornseth has an interest in not losing his employment, in losing his ability to earn a living while the security clearance process pays out. Under the system that we have here that Mr. Hornseth went through, the deciding official was unable to consider Mr. Hornseth's private interest at all. He was unable to take that into account. There were no circumstances, no matter what Mr. Hornseth said, that deciding official could consider his private interest and come to an alternative decision. We're not suggesting, and I want to be perfectly clear because I think the government brief kind of mischaracterizes it. Our position is not that Mr. Hornseth has a right to a specific alternative penalty. It's not that he has a right to have a deciding official pick that alternative. It's just that he has the right to go in front of someone who at least has authority to consider an alternative and at least a chance to impose that. The reality, of course, is that going to happen in a large percentage of circumstances? Probably not, right? We have a deciding official who works for the commander. Is he going to overturn the commander's decision? Probably in a very small number of cases would that ever happen. But Mr. Hornseth has the constitutional right to at least present his case to someone who can do something about it. He doesn't have a right to win. He doesn't have the right to have that alternative imposed. He just has a right to present his private interest and have that weighed against the government's strong interest.
Just one other question. In the record, in this is a little confusing, but Mr. Combs states in one of his emails, I guess it is, to Ms. Gardner, that there are no positions that do not require a security clearance. And he adds, it is fiscally irresponsible to generate an unneeded position to accommodate the request for work without a clearance. I am unable to offer a job not requiring a clearance. Can that not be read as an indication that he has weighed the question of whether to offer a job not requiring a clearance and finding that there's no fiscally responsible way to do that, that option is taken off the table by his decision?
No, Your Honor. I think if you, I don't have the citation at my fingertips, but there's two places in the record. One would be the cross-examination of Mr. Coombs at the MSRB hearing, and also in the request for admissions that were remitted
okay.
as a proposal.
That, I was going to ask you about that, because I think at Appendix 211, there is a statement which seems, this is why I said this was confusing, because that seems a little bit at odds with his email in which the statement is made. This is in the agreed upon facts. As all positions at the agency are designated sensitive, non-critical, the deciding official did not have the authority to create a position. So
right.
I sense that there was some tension between those two, and your position would be that it actually the latter is binding.
Yes, and I think if you look at the admissions as well as his testimony, we firmly established that all positions at the Puget Sound Naval Shipyard and require security clearance, There were no, it wasn't a question of one, is one of them available? There were none. There are none. And Mr. Combs made that perfectly clear, and the Navy admitted that in their request for admission. So that test or that statement in his decision about it would be fiscally irresponsible for me to create one is overruled by the fact that he had no authority to do that. There were no positions, and he could not reassign.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.
All rise. The Honorable Court is adjourned until tomorrow morning at 10 a.m.